Salo Falava, this is Pacific Waves from RNZ Pacific. I'm Susanna Suisuiki. Coming up,
France has shown their true face. The Kanak people are seen as the enemy.
A media professor says France is diminishing any future hopes of Kanaki independence. Also,
it's an injustice, and I think now is the time to do something about it.
Christchurch Samoans calls on the National Party to back the citizenship bill. And
I always felt very odd and uncomfortable in Pacifica events.
An exhibition in Wellington looks at the plights of Gurmit women in Fiji. A New Zealand author, journalist and media educator who has covered the Asia-Pacific region for more than two decades says liberation must come for Kanaki New Caledonia. Professor Roby sailed on board Greenpeace's flagship Rainbow Warrior until it was bombed by French secret agents in New Zealand. He has been arrested at gunpoint in New Caledonia and accused also of being a spy. The now director of Asia Pacific Report told Lydia Lewis France is torpedoing any hopes of Kanaki independence. Professor Roby spoke with Lydia Lewis, who began by asking him for his take of the riots so far.
It's a real tragedy because, you know, we had something like 35 years of building up goodwill since the 1980s when I was, as a journalist, covering what they called Les Événements, where it was basically almost a civil war, and dozens of people died during that period. And then we had the Matignon Accord came in 1988, and then the Nouméa Accord 10 years later. And there was gradual building up of goodwill between those who support independence and those who are absolutely opposed to it. And you have the situation right now where, in fact, politically, for the first time, the government, the territorial government of New Caledonia, is actually dominated by the pro-independence groups. And the president himself, Louis Mapu, he's pro-independence. And that's really the first time in the territorial government's happened. So it's caught everybody by absolute shock. It's going to be really hard. You think that 35 years just being wiped away like that in a few days. And it's going to be a huge challenge for France because basically, as far as I see it, France has betrayed the aspirations of the indigenous Kanak people. It's a self listed under the United Nations as a territory to be decolonized. And the whole spirit of the Nouméa Accord was to lead towards self-determination. And I think that progress was being made quite well with the first two votes on self-determination, the two referendums on independence, where there was a slight opposition, which narrowed in the second one, but the third one was a complete write-off because it was after COVID. You had a massive number of indigenous Kanaks who died during that period. From 2020 onwards, basically France lost the plot. It's had three prime ministers now since 2020. None of them seem to have any real affinity for indigenous issues, particularly in the South Pacific, in contrast to some previous prime ministers. So we've got a devastation, really, of this last week. It seems also, of course, that it's very different from back in the 1980s, where all the protests and demonstrations and so on were very well organised by the FNKS, the Kanak and Socialist National Liberation Front. This time, in the last week, it's been spontaneous. Like the protests began as usual legitimate protests, then they became violent and destruction and that sort of thing. And it's been spontaneous young people that have actually sort of done this. So it's going to be a challenge for basically for everybody. It's a challenge for French government to rebuild trust for a start. It's going to be a challenge for the FNKS to regain trust from the those that are opposed to independence, and also a challenge for the those who are opposed to independence, because essentially, liberation must come. You know, I mean, it's been the history all over the world that people that are colonised eventually. They achieve their aspirations and become independent. And I thought that France was actually on the right page over the last, just prior to this last 3 years, making progress. And then they just basically sort of effectively, I think, sabotaged the process, really. They weighed in very heavily with the anti-colonial forces. And I think the Kanak people felt they've lacked respect, the French government's lacked respect, and they're just simply not listening to them.
Charles Weir told me last week, we don't want to be like the Māori in New Zealand. We don't want to be like the Aboriginal people in Australia. And his reasoning for that was he doesn't want to be a minority in his own country. Mm. But aren't Kanaks already a minority in their own country?
Yes, they are. They are. But the demographics, the way, like, I mean, this is where the goodwill was brought in the Noumea cause in 1998. France brought in that the only people could participate in New Caledonian elections as opposed to the French state as a whole were indigenous Kanaks and those who've been living in New Caledonia prior to 1998. The indigenous Kanaks are still in a minority compared with that other group. There's a pretty close parity in a way, and also to bear in mind a lot of French people who've lived in New Caledonia for a long time believe in independence as well. And so there was a chance. But now, under this constitutional, I won't call it a reform, and I know a lot of media call it a reform. I think it's a very retrograde step, and this is the problem, because France has said, well with its constitutional change, which isn't yet law, although the National Assembly voted fairly decisively for it, there still has to be a combined vote.
That
in the
one
Senate.
Last step still.
Yes. And a lot can happen because they're obviously going to put that off for quite some time and try to get some kind of consensus happening. But what it means is you've got something like, for those who've been in New Caledonia for 10 years can vote. And so I don't know the exact number, but most figures seem to be being put out, 25,000 extra French voters. And those who are supporting or against independence say, well, this is democracy, you know, one person, one vote. But of course, it doesn't work in an indigenous environment like this, you see, and particularly when it's not a self-government, like it's supposed to be ultimately an independent nation. French people can vote in France anytime, like it's part of their democratic right. But it's a rather different situation in New Caledonia. So when you've got another 25,000, I've seen figures as up to as many as 40,000, then included in the vote, both in any future referendums or in the local provincial governments and the territorial governments, that's going to completely swamp Indigenous people.
Is this a deliberate step to erode and to wipe out the Indigenous vote in New Caledonia?
Well, my personal view is yes, absolutely. I think that's what's happened because I think previous prime ministers, and I mentioned, I think, Edouard Philippe, who was prime minister from 2017 to 2020, really had a good feeling for New Caledonia. And I think he was rather, you know, looked upon with from both sides with a lot of respect and so on. But then the prime minister changed, and we've had three prime ministers since then, and none of them seem to have really got the plot, really. And then the crucial thing was that after Philippe was moved to another portfolios and so on, the final referendum came in 2021. Now, the trajectory up until then, the two previous referendums, was there's a growing percentage for independence. Not quite as both the two previous ones were over 50% against, but the second one was higher for independence, and that, like, there'd been a rise. There was a very good chance that they could have got a yes vote for that third referendum. But what happened was, with the COVID, you had thousands of Kanaks dying, and under customary law and so on, or customary the protocols and so on, mourning is in Indigenous tribes in New Caledonia. It's a year's mourning. And there was no way that the FNKS or other political groups were going to be able to mount campaigns and so on before that referendum. So they appealed. They appealed for a delay. They were turned down and they weren't even really listened to at all. And then they made an appeal, I think it was to the Constitutional Court in France, and that was rejected on, you know, the sort of democracy grounds, you know, that sort of thing, quote unquote. And so basically they had nowhere to then turn. So from then on, I think the FNKS weren't going to sort of cooperate at all with negotiations about the future. And also they insisted that the vote on changes to the constitutional rules for voting in New Caledonia would be after there'd been a consensus. So, hopefully worked towards a consensus among the leadership of all the political groups. That consultation never happened. So it's sort of been railroaded in my view. And I think it's, it's really an intention to block any real prospect of the Kanak self-determination. And I think the reason why France did this was they thought, well, it's sufficiently, the no vote was sufficiently strong, just over the 50%, but it was enough to justify basically torpedoing any future hope of the Kanaks.
And this all needs to be wrapped up by the end of this year. It all needs to be, it's my understanding, that they need to get it finished by the end of this year. Talks need to happen by the end of this year. What possible steps towards independence could be taken? I mean, we're talking about negotiations here, parties getting together, but on the legal front, in terms of, proposals and, the Noumea Accord, what are the possibilities to work towards independence or not?
Well, my personal view is that they should scrap this proposed
is that possible, though?
It is anything, yes. It hasn't gone through the full process yet, but it'd have to have the goodwill and the vision. I think the vision is needed, because otherwise it's a pretty dire prospect in the future. Otherwise it'll be like a situation of trying to retain control by force rather than goodwill and consensus. But I believe that the moves to have a mission go out to New Caledonia, and the names that are being mentioned for this, probably a group of leaders, but two people in particular have been named that I think is very interesting, and that is Edouard Philippe, the former Prime Minister that I mentioned before, who seemed to have a good handle on New Caledonian affairs. And then another one, Lionel Jospin, who was Prime Minister at the time of the Noumea Accord. So he was a central figure in the drafting of that accord. So whether both of them or one or the other might be part of this group, mainly because I think that they realised that there would be a bit of trust, certainly among the more established leaders among the pro-independence Kanak groups, and probably well respected among the anti-independence as well, because what really is needed now is some kind of consensus.
So could goodwill come from these former leaders who, like you say, have previously had goodwill? Could they have a hand here in peaceful negotiations and a role in pushing France or suggesting to France to scrap this?
I think it is. I think it'd be a very positive move. Certainly it needs some energy like that to try, because I'd say that New Caledonia now is more polarised than ever. I mean, sad, really sad, because, think of 30 years, 35 years if you take it right back to the Montagnol Accord, but it's really three decades of hard work by a lot of people to build a future for New Caledonia, which is part of the Pacific rather than part of France. It's hopeful that something like that will happen. Certainly, it has to be some kind of charismatic change in the way things are at the moment.
And Pacific leaders, could they also play a role in this? They've come
out,
they've said that a big reason as to, having French territories as part of the Pacific family is a movement towards independence. So what role could Pacific leaders play, particularly with the upcoming Pacific Islands Forum, in supporting that speaking to France even?
Yes, well, and also most civil society groups have been calling for the scrapping of this, constitutional change, because that's really the source of the problems. And it's important to remember that both New Caledonia And I like to call it Kanaka New Caledonia, because that's really a recognition, just as we call Aotearoa
as
New Zealand.
Should we, as media, be calling it Kanaki New
my view,
Caledonia?
Yes, and I do routinely in my media.
Why should we be doing that if it's not recognised sort of at a higher level as that?
Well, it is recognised in the sense that it's been customary up until now, just the same as the Kanak flag is flown alongside the French tricolour. You know, it's a very similar sort of thing, and it's like in New Zealand, it's informal that we refer to Aotearoa New Zealand, and some media do, including me.
You mentioned briefly you've been reporting on this for decades. Can you take me back to the days when you were on the ground? And I even read that you were arrested. Can you take me back to those volatile days that you were reporting?
Yeah, well, as a journalist, I was freelance in those days, but reporting for a lot of media around the Pacific. And reporting, I think, from a Pacific perspective rather than necessarily New Zealand or Australian, although I was reporting for Radio Australia and also RNZ. Thank you for RNZ's great. And I was also reporting for Pacific Islands Monthly and Islands Business and a number of other publications as well. So it's always seeing the region from the Pacific perspective and how New Caledonia fits into that. I made a number of trips to New Caledonia during that period. And I did get arrested twice, in fact, but the first time was actually at gunpoint, which was slightly unnerving, because I knew what were they arresting me for. They accused me of being a spy. This was over in a village called Kanala. It was during the actual protests, the Les Evenements, and I was in Kanala at the time when there was a leader that got assassinated eventually, and he basically had an axe, and I got a photograph of him with his axe on his shoulders, but I didn't know what was going to happen. Eloy Mushiro was his name, and he was just going off. This was during a referendum that was being boycotted at the time by the FNKS supporters, and he was just going off to the polling booth in Kanala. And unfortunately, I missed this actual moment, but I got him just before it was happening with this axe, and this photograph has been used quite widely around the world. And what he planned to do was chop open the ballot box, and they burnt all the ballot paper. So this was highly symbolic of the resistance by the Kanak pro-independence people, as it will. France hated him. He was the Minister of Security with the FNKS at the time, whereas, of course, from Paris's point of view, they saw him as the Minister of Insecurity. So he had a target on his back, and eventually he was actually killed by snipers. By profession, he was a school teacher. And he's just really thrust into this role during the uprising at the time. Mostly it was a series of skirmishes. There were blockades all over Grande Terre, which is the main island, and so on, and also in the Loyalty Islands as well. And there were skirmishes, but there were a number of assassinations. Mostly it was very, very, we talk about heavy-handed French response at the moment. It was far, far more heavy-handed back then. In fact, I just can't quite remember the figures now, but there's the French military combined, the military, gendarmerie and police at that time were a higher number than, say, New Zealand's armed forces. And you think, well, what was the population? Now, the population of New Caledonia today is around about 270,000, according to the 2019 census. But, of course, it was a lot smaller then. So you think it's a highly militarised.
And around anyway, 30 deaths as well.
I didn't tell you why I was actually arrested, why I was accused of being a spy. Well, I'd read in news magazines in France, because, you know, it was very well covered by the French journalists all the time, about the militarisation of small villages all around New Caledonia, mainly on the east coast and so on. And they were using a technique that was used in Algeria in the War of Independence there, what they call nomadization, which means you put in a garrison in the village, and then the soldiers go out at night and bang on the doors of homes and basically terrorize the community. And it's all about intimidation. Basically, keep keep the Indigenous people quiet and that sort of thing. And I'd read about this and I thought, oh, this is a very good story for a reason. I hadn't read anything about it in any of the English language media. So I thought, well, that's one of my missions. So that particular trip, I'd go and report about this. So I went to Kanala and I had a Kanaka official with me from the local territorial government in Umea. He was sort of my guide in a sense, but he was driving, I sort of took photographs. We went past one of these nomadization outposts, the military set up and so on, and of course I just took photographs. I didn't think there was anything wrong with that because it had been done already by French journalists. And next thing, it was a roadblock set up just down the road. And there were soldiers there, and this officer came straight up to me, and he said, "Monsieur Irby," and so on. And well, yes. And they arrested me on the spot. But what I did was change my cameras. I had a camera around my neck, and I had another camera, and I quickly changed the camera and so on. And they seized the film. So they took me to the gendarmerie, and I was handed over to the gendarmes. The military handed me over to the gendarmes and so on. And then they got out statute books and so on, that sort of thing, and there was sort of reference to being a spy, which was ridiculous, but it's still pretty unnerving from a journalist's point of view. You're not quite sure what's going to happen there. And they refused to allow me to phone the New Zealand consulate in Umea at the time. But it's all just intimidating. But the funny thing, I have to tell you about this, funny thing was, we were separated. The guy who was with me, he was driving, and he's official, actually, you know, part of the officials of the local government and so on. He was put in one room, and I was put in another room. And they questioned both of us separately, and I was thinking, I can't put this guy in all sorts of trouble. He might lose his job or something like that, you know. And so I'm sort of telling the interviewers and so on, well, I just got picked up, you know, I'm just a freelancer, I'm just picked up, and this guy gave me a lift, you see. And he's telling me, oh, we've known him for a long time, he's one of our journalists.
You'd think you'd get your story straight that one.
We didn't have a chance, you see, of course.
What context can you give to Charles Ware's, you know, quote that he doesn't want his people to be like Māori and Aotearoa or First Nation peoples in Australia?
Yes. Well, I think the comparison is much more with Australia rather than, I mean, Aotearoa New Zealand is probably the better aspects of what we have is more of an example of what could be in New Caledonia. But you have to recall that New Caledonia began life just like the colonial life, just like Australia, penal colony. They shipped off, Algerian fighters for independence. They shipped off Vietnamese fighters during the Vietnam War. And some of the other minorities, because a lot of people realise that they think, well, it's French and Kanak. It's not. It's a lot more mixed than that, a lot more complicated, in that many of the earlier people have had these backgrounds of the struggles, but they identify often with France. Anyway, so it's much more of a comparison with Australia in that basically France had the attitude, oh, this is there's no respect for the indigenous values and so on. There were executions. In fact, I mean, we ran something just the other day about marking the execution of 10 people resisting, Kanak people resisting French control a century and a half ago, and they were executed by the guillotine, and there's a memorial for them. That was just being honoured at the weekend. We have the Te Riti, that sets quite a big difference. There's no equivalent to that in New Caledonia. But I think what probably Charles Ware is referring to is that honouring of Indigenous aspirations and values that New Zealand has, but it's also referring to the dispossession of land, a dispossession of culture and language and so on as well, even though there's been a lot of progress made over the last 50, 70 years or so in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
That's right. And also some Kanaki locals told me when I was there last month that they're terrified of their culture being ripped away from them, that their children don't want to learn their one of their many languages, because there are many languages.
It's not
just like Te Reo Māori and Aotearoa. They've got many languages, and they only learn two of the languages in schools. But the kids would just rather learn French or English. So that's a very real, I guess, fear for the current. Was there anything that I missed? Like always, I always do long interviews, so I like listening to you, but I mean...
Well, look, I'll just raise one comment, because I was in touch with a Kanak politician that I know who's... she's a former journalist too, but anyway, I've known her for quite a few years, and she travels a lot internationally as well. But she just made this comment to me. She said, well, France have shown their true face. The Kanak people are seen as the enemy. And I hope that's a rather depressing thought, but I hope it's not going to be like that. I really hope that France listens and realizes it has to change track. It has to have a consensus. And that's what was being built over the previous, you know, three decades that I mentioned. So hopefully there's a real positive rethink now on their policies, because certainly militarization, even if it may be needed right at this moment to restore law and order and so on, is not the way to go for the future.
Does the media play a role, particularly in Aotearoa, in projecting this view?
Glad you asked that, because I think that I think it's a very important issue. New Caledonia is our closest neighbour. It's 3 hours, 3 hours away on a flight, and yet the media basically ignores it. Except, you know, as a tourist destination and so on. And of course, if you go there as a tourist, you see this white city, this affluent white city, and you don't really get a sense of the tribu out there.
It's Europe that's 2 hours away.
Yes. Unfortunately, I've felt this for a long time, that New Zealand media, they regard the Pacific as really the Polynesian triangle. They, a little bit in Micronesia and a little bit in Melanesia. And in many ways, the economic... the most important economic countries, and in a sense, partly because of that politically, are Papua New Guinea, New Caledonia, Vanuatu, and Fiji, of course. Well, Fiji gets really good coverage. But we've had the skewed concentration on parts of the Pacific because we have the diaspora here, the large diasporas, but we've more or less ignored those other countries. And so when something like this happens, this last week, all these riots, why are there riots, you know? Whereas if we had more systematic reporting, and I know, I really acknowledge RNZ Pacific, because you did a fantastic job. I'm really talking about the mainstream media outside of RNZ Pacific at the moment. We just don't get a sense of that. And I mean, look at the Herald. I mean, for 2 days, they didn't have anything on this crisis at all. And then they did over the next couple of days, but they relied on your stories. And I thought, well, they've got the biggest reporting team in the country. What are they doing? But you see, the thing is that if you have journalists going, as like Walter Zweifel for RNZ, regularly went to New Caledonia before and interviewed lots of people and so on. And we've got Patrick now. And, you know, that it builds up a sort of a knowledge over a period of time. And so when something happens big, it's easy just to shift key a bit and follow up those leads and the contacts that they have. If the other media are not doing that, they don't know who to contact, and then... Well, language might be a barrier there, because they concentrate, I think, too much on the tourists, but and a lot of other people who don't really know what's going on. And so you only just get a sort of like a half pie coverage of the crisis, how it's affecting New Zealanders, which is very important, of course, and Australians in the same boat sort of thing. But we don't really get an understanding of what are the deeper issues, why is this happening, and what are the hopes for the future.
And does that also project the Indigenous population as the bad guys?
Yes, I think it's a projection that basically, they're young people, I would expect that they're actually sort of looting and causing fires and that sort of thing. They don't get an appreciation of just how absolutely frustrated young people feel. It's 50% of unemployment as a result of the nickel industry collapse, you know.
And a major divide of poverty and, you know, affluence as well.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So all this has sort of played into it. And there's been a lot of references that the leadership of the FNKS have lost control of the youth. But you have to weigh that up against the this absolute frustration that's gone on for years. Because even though I've probably given a little bit of a positive view of the political changes over three decades before the last 3 years, but not a lot has been done to change the economic disparities. In fact, they've got worse probably in those years.
One comparison, well, I'd like to know if you think we can draw a comparison, is the wording used by the French government. Back then, Kanaks were called terrorists, and now strong words have been used in the finger-pointing game.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. Well, I'm glad you raised that too, because I think they've made They've made the CCAT, the field groups that are not the official independence parties by any means, but of course they have an association. And people like Christian Tien and so on, a leader, quite a charismatic leader, and others, they've made them scapegoats. They put all the blame on them, and that's not the reason. You know, like, I don't believe that those leaders actually had intended all this to unfold over the last couple of weeks. It's sort of like once the protests reached a level of anger and frustration, it just sort of all hell broke loose, you know. But they have been made the scapegoats, whereas the real culprits are the French government, and particularly the last three prime ministers, in my view.
Christchurch's Samoan community met to discuss Green Party MP Te Anau Tō Yono's bill that, if passed, will restore entitlement to New Zealand citizenship to some Samoans. Caleb Fotheringham spoke to community members at St Paul's Trinity Pacific Presbyterian Church who are keen to see it go through.
Christchurch Samoan community gathered together to discuss a bill that, if passed, will reverse a nearly 40-year-old law. In 1982, the Privy Council ruled that all Western Samoans born between 1924 and 1948 were considered natural-born British subjects and were also New Zealand citizens. But the Muldoon government passed a law effectively overturning that ruling. Green Party MP Te Anau Tō Yono's bill will restore the right of citizenship to those who had it removed. Whanuma Aitu Tuvalu Foimaono says this time he doesn't want to see politicians play politics and wants parties to align with the 1982 Privy Council decision.
We're not saying that, hey, let's play politics with this. We're saying, hey, do the right thing. And the right thing is give back to those people that right that was granted to them by the judiciary in 1982. It's simple as that.
He says New Zealand failed Samoa many times in the 20th century.
And then New Zealand turn around and add, you know, more salt onto all those wounds from the past and, you know, and from the days of the Dawn Raids. It's an injustice, and I think now is the time to do something about it.
National was the only party to not support the bill through the first reading about a month ago. NZ First leader Winston Peters told Pacific Media Network his party intends to back it the whole way, which will give the bill the numbers needed to pass.
Let's see what happens to the Select Committee, but that is our intention, to get where a number of the people in that bill want to go, because that's always been our view. But also, I'm having regard to Prime Minister Fiamme saying to me that they're concerned about depopulation. This could very quickly go wrong. I want to know what they think as well.
Christchurch Samoan community member Fa'o Sophia Seliato Daly wants National to jump on board. She says it's an opportunity for the party to finally do something for Samoa.
What has National done for Samoa? And this is the big question that I'd like to ask National. What makes you scared of having this bill passed? And I keep thinking, National, if they do this and pass this bill through their support, it will go down through the history of the National Party.
Fa'o Sophia says Samoans have not been recognised for their unique relationship with New Zealand. She says because Samoa was colonised by New Zealand, they should be treated the same as Cook Islanders, Niueans and Tokelauans.
We were colonised by New Zealand, but at the same time, when you were excluded from that, like, you've been treated just like every other islands or nations that they never had that colonial relationship with New Zealand, it becomes quite a troubling a thought.
National didn't support the bill because of its legal complexity, but Mr. Toyono doesn't believe this should be a barrier.
Is it complex? Maybe. Even if it is, let's work it out. Have the commitment, have an open heart to actually work through that complexity. I think we can do it.
Many people who attended the meeting wanted to see citizenship extended to descendants, not just to the around 5,000 elders who are still alive. Mr. Toyono says it will be a discussion for the select committee.
With the grant part, I think that's where the debate with the committee will possibly end up being as to, you know, who qualifies and who doesn't.
Public submissions for the bill close at the end of the month.
The Pacific is again the big winner from the Australian aid program in this year's budget. The Australian aid spending in the coming year will be up slightly, reversing years of slow decline under the Coalition, and the Pacific is getting a greater share. Don Wiseman spoke with Professor Stephen Howes of the Australian National University's Development Policy Centre about the aid allocations.
They've said they're rebuilding the aid program. They're certainly preventing further cuts to it, but it is really much more a stabilisation in real terms, that is after inflation, rather than a rebuild, you know, which would have to imply an increase greater than inflation. And the problem with just keeping it level with inflation is that it means that as a ratio of our gross national income, which is the generosity index that we use to compare aid programs around the world, Australia's already a laggard and we're already below 0.2, and that ratio will keep falling without a real aid increase.
There's a greater focus on the Pacific this year.
That's right. So the Pacific seems to always emerge as a winner, no matter what happens to the overall aid program. That's because its share of the aid program continues to increase. And, you know, it's quite remarkable if you take a longer-term view, look back over the last decade, about 10 years ago, it was about 20%, just over 20% of the aid program that went to the Pacific, and now it's just over 40%. It's about 42%. So it's a remarkable increase, and no doubt the biggest change that has happened in terms of the composition of our spending over the last 10 years. This year, it's a fairly small increase to the Pacific, but it's focused on two countries, so it's pretty substantial increases for those two countries, and those are Tuvalu and Fiji. Tuvalu with the new treaty with Australia, there's funding to implement that, and somewhat related to that, there's a new submarine cable for Tuvalu that Australia's helping to pay for. And Fiji, there's an agreement to provide ongoing budget support to help Fiji as it emerges from the pandemic. And also, very recently, Australia agreed to upgrade one of Fiji's ports under the aid program. So that'll also require more funding.
So we have specifics about how the money to Tuvalu will be spent?
Well, we know the amount of money, and it's a huge increase for Tuvalu. Its aid this year, so 23-24, the year that's finishing, is $17 million. But next year, which is the budget year, 24-25, that's going to go to $87 million. So from $17 million to $87 million, it's a massive increase. Yeah, we understand the biggest single portion of that is for this submarine cable. But then on top of that, there'll be additional funding to implement the provisions of the new treaty between Australia and Tuvalu. That treaty, for example, is going to give Tuvalu a right to immigrate to Australia, not in unlimited numbers, but in significant numbers, almost 300. And to do that, you know, Australia wants to strengthen Tuvalu's sort of migration regime, passport regime, I guess to make sure that it's only legitimate citizens of Tuvalu that end up in Australia.
Budgetary support, this is increasingly important to the Australian government. I think the Development Policy Centre is also supportive of that.
Yeah, that's right. It sort of waxed and waned over the life of the aid program. You know, really when the aid program began, if we go right back to the 70s, the biggest spending item was budget support to the newly independent Papua New Guinea. That of course, completely disappeared now. Or had disappeared. But budget support has re-emerged, especially over COVID, as countries faced a lot of fiscal stress. What they really needed was not more projects, you know, more consultants, more reports, but they just needed money to fund essential services. So budget support re-emerged over the pandemic period. But if we look at 22-23, which is the last year for which we have data on this, it was up at 9%, just above 9% of total aid spending, and that's the largest it's been for the last decade. So it looks like the government's continuing with budget support, and we support that. It can be a very effective form of aid. It's certainly an aid that partner governments ask for, and it's very consistent with one of the major thrusts of the government's aid policy, which it released last year, which is this idea of localization or locally led development. And that's saying that development really needs to come from within. It can't be imposed from the outside. And so you need to support local organisations. And of course, that's often interpreted as local NGOs. And that's important. But obviously, supporting national government is also, or we think, it's a critical part of any localisation agenda.
Is there a mechanism in place to ensure that that money doesn't end up in MPs / funds as they exist in the Melanesian countries?
Yeah, well, that's always the question asked. And, you know, it is that concern about corruption and fraud. With budget support, you can't ring fence your funding. If you want to ring fence it, then you need to have your own aid projects. And that's why most of the aid program does consist of separate projects. You know, so we are only talking about 10% of the aid program. We're not talking about the majority of spending. So there is that risk, increased risk of misuse, but there are lots of benefits as well. And the benefits are those of relevance that, you know, if you're just giving projects, you're pushing yourselves into the margins, you're doing your own thing, and you have no influence over what is the main game in town, which is government policy and spending. Whereas if you are actually funding the budget, then you're able to enter into a dialogue with the government and try and improve the quality not just of your spending but of overall government spending. And budget support also provides a way in which donors can coordinate. So typically it's not just Australia providing budget support, but it could be Australia with New Zealand, and it could also be with the World Bank and or the ADB. And so again, that helps because in these small countries, each individual project might be good, but there are so many donors, so many projects, it overwhelms the government, whereas this is a much more streamlined approach of funding into the budget. And that's one reason why it is so popular with recipient governments.
A new art exhibition exploring the plights of Gamete women in Fiji has just launched in Wellington, New Zealand. More than 60,000 Indians were brought to Fiji by the British colonisers between 1879 to 1916 to work on the sugarcane, banana and rubber plantations. Porirua-based artist Seema Singh created a collection of paintings uncovering the lives of the Indian women of the Gamete era, which involved slavery, murder and prostitution. The free event runs until May 26th at the New Zealand Academy of Fine Arts Gallery on Queen's Wharf. Alicia Foon spoke with Mrs. Singh about how researching her heritage led to the discovery of countless stories of Gamete women and the conditions they faced in this two-part series.
When I moved to New Zealand, I had this identity crisis kind of thing because I was from Fiji, but I felt that I was Indian as well, and you know, I was not recognized as a specific person. I always felt very odd and uncomfortable in Pacifica events because I used to be one of those, you know, the Fiji Indian person amongst all the other Pacific Islander people. And so this is when I started thinking about, you know, who I am. I'm very proud of my Fijian heritage, very proud of my Indian heritage. You know, I wanted to ground myself, okay, and try and figure out who I was, I think, you know. And then that's taken a long time, actually. Now, like after, I don't know, 15 years or so, I started pondering about, you know, what I can do in order to understand my life and my identity better. So that's when I started talking about, I'll read a little bit about my Gamete heritage because I'm an artist. I work in the climate science field, but I'm an artist as well. So I decided that I wanted to do something with the knowledge that I was gaining as I was researching. The best way I could do that was through an exhibition, you know, as an artist's point of view. I am very interested in, you know, women's lives. I'm surrounded by women. We are three, mom and three daughters, and I have a daughter now. So, you know, I'm very comfortable with the topic of women. So I decided to narrow my exhibition's topic to Gamete women.
It sounds like this journey for you has been quite a significant one, and perhaps the exhibition that you've created is your way of of reconciling your own identity, but also helping others become aware of theirs, and educating people as well. I guess, what would you like people to know about Gidmit women? Because for a lot of people, this information has been buried for a long time. And what have you found?
The Gidmit women, firstly, I call myself a Pacific Islander. In all those gatherings that I go to, where all Pacific people are, they do not know about the plight of the Indian people to the Pacific and how, why we, so many Fiji Indians are in this particular area. Or when they go to Fiji, there's a lot of people of Indian origin. 38% of their population is Fiji Indians. But nobody really actually knows how they came about being there, so many of them. So I want people to know, especially my Pacific people, I want to start at home and maybe go out to the world later on. But I want my Pacific people to know that Fiji Indians were brought by the British to Fiji to work on cotton plantations, sugarcane plantations, rubber plantations, banana plantations in 1879. And they were bound with a 5-year contract to work on these plantations. And, you know, they had the choice to go back home or stay back. But at the end of the 5 years, they were not able to collect enough money to go back home, to pay for their way back home. So some of them decided to stay. These women, the women that came, so there were 35 or 33 women for every 100 men. So there was only 1/3 of the population that was women. And these women, they encountered many issues. There were so many social problems because of this big gender disparity. That's what I'm trying to highlight here, that these women survived, these women fought back. And as a result of their sacrifices, you know, their retaliation, you know, I'm able to stand here and have a voice. Their voices were not heard. There were lots of things that happened to them. They were raped. They were, you know, murders. They were murdered because of adultery. And so many other reasons. They were whipped because they could not go to work. They were sick, or because they had just become mothers. And so there were lots of things that happened to them, which nowadays would be really, really illegal, and people could go to jail.
You're talking about slavery and prostitution, aren't you?
There's lots of things written about the issues that they faced. Slavery is one of them. They just renamed the slavery system as indentured system. So, you know, it was still slavery, but they had, because slavery had been abolished in 1933, I think, and they wanted to continue using Indian people to work on the plantations. They named it indenture. And the difference between slavery and indenture is slavery is for life. Indenture was for 5 years. So, you know, that was the thing. Yeah. And then women, yes, they would have been. I've just done my research for 9 months. And prostitution, etc., these were all the everyday reality of those women. You know, I can't even imagine how their lives were. You know, I've read books, I've read these things. And you cry, and I've cried. So, yeah, I mean, there are so many stories. People don't realize how hard the life of the Gidmit women was. Through this exhibition, you know, it's like a place of conversation, starting a conversation about Gidmit people. But I just want to talk through my art and just tell the stories as how I see it.
Tune in next episode for part 2 of this discussion on why Seema Singh wants Fijian Indians to be officially recognized as Pacific people. That's Pacific Waves for today. To listen back, head over to rnz.co.nz/Pacific. We're also on Spotify, Apple and iHeartRadio. From myself and the RNZ Pacific team, tō whā soifua.